used both as a textbook and a course, but also as a book for the proverbial intelligent layman who thinks it would be fun to learn stuff. And if you're an intelligent layman, you probably don't want to have a quarter of the area of the page covered with footnotes, whereas, as everybody knows, legal books are almost entirely footnotes. I think I remember one of my colleagues at one point who had the project never completed to write a law review article that consisted entirely of quotes and footnotes, nothing else. But I know that Richard Craswell, who used to be at Chicago and is now at Stanford, at one point wrote a poem in which the last line of every verse was a footnote. So I decided that I would solve the problem by moving my footnotes to cyberspace, which is what I did here. This is a sheet which you're supposed to fill out so I can figure out when my office hours are. Here, you get one too. Notice the sheet also has the URL both for the class webpage and for my webpage. My webpage is easier to remember. It's daviddfriedman.com, and it has links to the class webpage. So if you get to it, that will get you eventually. If you forget where this is, go to here. That's daviddfriedman.com, and go down a bit to where I discuss my courses. All right. So, in addition to my book, there are a couple of articles in the syllabus which I link to. One of them is a very famous article by Ronald Coase, and one is a much less famous article by me, but both, I think, are relevant to the material that we're going to be doing. So before I go on to talk about what economics is, any questions on the mechanics of the course? No? All right. I should say I am recording it when I remember to do so, and assuming my battery doesn't run out, and I then web those recordings in order that if you want to review a class or if you were sick and missed a class, you can get it that way as well. The other reason I do that is that I have in mind a hypothetical very, very smart student somewhere in Bombay or Delhi or Shanghai who would like to learn this stuff, is not going to come to America, is not going to pay me any money, but is willing to go to the trouble of learning it by listening to a recording instead of sitting in class. And I want him to end up with my ideas, and it costs me essentially nothing to make them available. My general view is that the web is a wonderful technology for giving information away, but a rather clumsy technology for selling information, and that therefore the secret of making proper use of the web is finding ways in which you can achieve what you want to achieve by giving information away. All right. What is economics? A lot of people think of economics as a set of issues, that economics is about inflation or about unemployment or about things having to do with money. From my standpoint, and that of many, though not all, economists, those are questions that economics might help you answer, but that's not what economics is. That what economics is a way of understanding behavior. And it can be applied to understanding any behavior. At least you can try to. It may or may not work like other ways. My first published economics article was A Theory of the Size and Shape of Nations, in which I tried to offer an explanation of the general features of the map of Europe from the fall of the Roman Empire to the present, in which I was modeling nations as competing for territory in a rational fashion, where a nation in effect decided how much it was worth to it to get some piece of land, and that determined how hard it would fight or how much it would bargain or other ways how it would compete, and the land tended to move to the nation willing to offer most for it, and under some circumstances that led to large nations and some circumstances small. Similarly, Gary Becker at Chicago, a fairly well-known Nobel Prize-winning economist, his specialty is really the economics of the family, although he's done other things as well. Jim Buchanan got his Nobel Prize for applying economics to understanding political institutions, what's called public choice theory. And what we're going to be doing is applying economics to making sense of the law. What's the defining characteristic of that way of understanding behavior? It's an assumption that economists call rationality, somewhat misleadingly, And what we mean by rationality is that the best way of predicting the behavior of strangers is to assume that they will take the actions that best achieve their objectives. And it doesn't mean that they are infinitely intelligent. It doesn't mean that you run a complicated spreadsheet model every time you're trying to decide whether to go out for a drink. But it does mean that in some average sense, your behavior can be predicted as the behavior that achieves your objectives. As evidence that rationality is not the same thing as rational thinking, I like to offer the examples of the rational baby and the rational cat. Try to imagine that you are an infant, say a month old. Some of you may even have been infants at one time in the past. You're in a world over which you have very little control. You can't actually make your hands do what you want or your feet do what you want. You have only a single tool with which to influence the world, and that's your voice. So when the situation is unsatisfactory, when you are hungry or wet or cold, you make loud, unpleasant noises. And when you make loud, unpleasant noises, big people come and fix the problem. Given the limits of your tools, it's not clear there's any better strategy available to you. Now, the reason babies behave in this way is not that they understand that their noises are unpleasant to grown-ups. The reason, presumably, is that over the past million years or so, those babies that when they were hungry stayed quiet did not survive. The ones who made noises did survive. The ones who made noises that were really unpleasant to grown-ups got the grown-ups' attention first and were more likely to survive, and thus Darwinian evolution gives us rational babies. For another example, I don't know if any of you have ever had a cat as a roommate. Some of us had. And you may have had the experience in the morning of sitting down to breakfast and reading the newspaper when you should have been petting the cat. And the cat has a simple solution to this problem. The cat lies down on the newspaper. Since the cat is opaque, you are unable to read the newspaper through it, and so fall back on your second best alternative of petting the cat. Now, I think it unlikely that cats understand the nature of newspapers and reading. I don't think this is a strategy that came from rational analysis, but I presume it came from trial and error, that on some occasion the cat thought that was a nice place to lie down, and sure enough it got petted, and being a sensible beast, it adopted that policy as a way of getting attention when it wanted it. So those suggest that rationality doesn't necessarily come from explicit calculation. It might. It could be produced by evolution, as in the case of babies, or by trial and error. Or it could be produced by selection. Suppose you're thinking about the CEOs of companies. A random person put in charge of Microsoft would probably not have a very good idea of how to maximize Microsoft's profits. But of course, the person who is in charge of Microsoft is not a random person. There is a selection mechanism in which, on the whole, people who are good at maximizing companies' profits are more likely to end up in a position where they're controlling large companies, and that means that companies are, as it were, more nearly rational than you might expect, given the amount of irrationality you observe in the world around us. Similarly, I think I know the fastest way to get from here to my home or the other way around. I have not actually done a careful geometric calculation complete with figures on traffic speed, but I've tried different routes and I have a rough idea how long it took, so by trial and error I find what I think is the optimal route. I could be wrong, I should say. At one point I was going to my doctor's and just for fun I asked my cell phone, which has a GPS built into it, how I should go. And it took me a different and I think better route than I had ever had, but a rather indirect one that had not occurred to me to try. The assumption of rationality, like lots of other assumptions in other sciences, does not have to be true to be useful. Most of us observe irrationality in other people, and some of us even observe it in ourselves. I have noticed, for example, that even though I'm overweight and would like to weigh less, that if there is a bowl of potato chips within arm's reach, it mysteriously empties itself. And that sounds like irrational behavior given my objectives. The argument for assuming rationality really is that we don't have a good theory of mistakes. That is to say that real human behavior is some mixture of rational behavior and mistakes, rational behavior and actions that don't best achieve your objectives. That unless you have a theory of what mistakes people will make, assuming they will act rationally, may come as close to correctly behaving, correctly predicting their behavior as you're able to come. Now, in the case of yourself, you may be able to do better. Thus, for instance, I try to avoid situations where there's a bowl of potato chips within arm's reach because I know that I have that particular failure of rationality. On one occasion, back when I was a faculty fellow at Chicago, it was during the summer, and I mentioned to Judge Posner, who was a colleague at the time, that I had not paid for a parking space in the law school parking lot because I lived at a distance from the law school such that riding a bike in was practical, although a little bit tiring. I thought I needed the exercise, and by not having a convenient parking place, I made it more likely that I would choose to ride my bike. And Judge Posner responded that he thought I believed in rationality, and if I was rational, I should be able to make the choice between driving and riding a bike, taking account of the health effects of riding a bike, without having to rig the game by not having a parking place. And my response was that rationality was an assumption about other people, because I have much more detailed information about myself, and I'm thus in a better position to predict what ways I will deviate from rationality and to try to make my outcomes more rational precisely by compensating for my known errors. Now, I don't want to overstate the case because, of course, there are theories of mistakes. How good they are, I'm not quite sure. Have any of you read the book Nudges by Sunstein and Thaler? It's gotten a good deal of attention. And part of what it's about is what's called behavioral economics, which is the attempt to observe patterns of irrationality that are predictable. And I think behavioral economics is very much a work in progress, but nonetheless an interesting work in progress. It's not what I'm going to be discussing this semester, but it is one example of an attempt to go beyond rationality and to say, well, part of human behavior is rational, part of it is randomly irrational, but part of it is irrational in predictable ways. I actually have an article, which is linked to my webpage, if you're curious enough, on economics and evolutionary psychology, in which I take evolutionary psychology, which is basically the application of evolutionary biology to understanding how people think, and try to use it to explain patterns of behavior that are puzzling to an economist. There are a variety of observed behaviors which I, as an economist, can prove don't exist, but inconveniently do. And in that article, I try to say, suppose evolutionary biology looks a lot like economics, it turns out. Economists like it. And the reason is that evolutionary biology has its own kind of rationality. Evolutionary biology says organisms are designed for reproductive success by evolution, as if designed for reproductive success. And the logic of how would you design an organism, including its behavior, to maximize reproductive success looks a lot like the logic of how a rational individual would choose to maximize his utility or his income or some other. Here, this is a form for telling me when you want my office hours to be. The difference between evolutionary biology and economics, there are two differences. The first is the evolutionary biologists know what the utility function is, because they know what all living creatures are designed to maximize, namely success in getting their genes into future generations, whereas economists can only say, well, we observe that people want certain sorts of things. On the other hand, evolutionary biology has much longer time lags than economics because it takes much longer to alter an organism's genetic characteristics than it does to make up your mind to change your strategy. So the article you may find interesting is an attempt to see what happens if you replace the economist assumption with the evolutionary biologist assumption and try to then explain patterns of behavior that the economists find puzzling. But that's just one example. I actually came across an example of arguably predictable irrationality, which might be of interest to you since it's basically about your irrationality. It was in the New York Times, I think, yesterday. And it was a rather depressing but perhaps correct article about people going to law school, which argued, in effect, that going to law school was almost always a mistake, that it cost much more than on average people made. And the article partly blamed this on the law schools, which, if argued probably correctly, exaggerate how good your odds are of getting a good job coming out of them in the course of trying to persuade U.S. News and World Report to put them higher up in its rankings. But it argued that there was a second reason for the problem, and the second reason was that everybody was an optimist. That people going into law school say, well, I realize that only a minority of graduates of law school end up with $200,000 a year jobs as associates or partners in firms or with more money than that as partners, but I'm going to be one of the winners. And what struck me, one of the people they quoted was suggesting this might be a characteristic of millennials, which is some term for, I think, your generation. I'm not quite sure why. And I thought that was rather amusing because precisely the same observation appears in The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. Adam Smith comments that there are certain professions, and law is one he names, which on average are bad gambles. And he argues that one of the two reasons for this is that people are optimists. And especially young people just at the age when they're choosing a profession are especially likely to have a rosy view, not only of their own abilities, but of their own luck. Not a quote, but that's essentially what he says. So I thought it was amusing, at least. I put up a blog post under the title... forget the title anyway, something about everything staying the same forever kind of thing on that subject. But that's an example of pattern irrationality. If you really knew that it was true that people age 18 to 26 were consistently over-optimistic, that would give you certain predictions about, for example, the prediction that professions with very uneven outcomes would tend on average to be underpaid. Because the people who chose to go into them would do so too optimistically and thus drive down the return. But, again, these are all, in a sense, digressions because the basic sort of meat and potatoes version of economics ignores all that stuff and just treats people as rational. It's a nice simplified assumption. Let me stop just for a moment. My subject so far is what is economics? Are there questions? About economics, about rationality, about any of this stuff. I ask your questions reasonably quickly because I like talking. Therefore, it's a great requires a great effort of will to stop talking long enough to listen. There's another ex-colleague of mine from a long time ago, Gordon Tullock, who's a very weird guy who's written a lot of stuff. And he had an exchange with some other prominent economist where Tullock had written an article criticizing an article by the other guy, and the other guy wrote a response in which he started out by saying that he, like many others, had always been impressed by how much Gordon Tullock had written, and it was even more impressive to realize that he had written so much without knowing how to read. And went on, of course, to argue that his article had been misrepresented in Tullock's response. All right, no questions? All right. So, if economics is the way of understanding behavior that starts from the assumption that individuals have objectives and tend to pursue them, tend to take the actions that best achieve them, what does that have to do with law? And I think the answer is that an economist looks at law, at legal rules, as an incentive system. The fundamental question is, given these rules, how will people find it in their interest to behave? And there are quite a lot of examples when, if you think of the question in that way, you may come up with answers that don't fit the reasons that people are in favor of the rules. Because a rule designed to make you do A may, in fact, make it an interest to do B. Let me take one example, which I was thinking of not long ago. And that's the question which various people at this school are concerned about the conviction of innocence. When you hear a story where DNA testing proves that somebody spent 20 years in prison never committed the crime he was in prison for, and in some of those cases when at least it's argued that not only was he innocent, but it should have been obvious he was innocent, that he got into jail due to misdeeds of one sort or another by the prosecution or the police or whatever. And the gut reaction of a lot of people is he ought to be compensated and the people responsible should be paying it. That prosecutor ought to owe $400,000 or whatever to the guy he put into jail, and if that means he has to sell his house, tough luck. Suppose you had such a law. Suppose we had a legal regime in which when it turned out that somebody who had been convicted and punished was innocent, the people who had played the central role in getting him into prison were civilly liable, or criminally, say, make it civilly for a moment, for very large damages. What would be the effects of that rule? You might have to pay prosecutors more. You'd have to get insurance and such. Of course, it's a pretty rare event, so it might not be very expensive insurance. What are the other effects? First, what's the desirable effect? Yeah?
Well, the desirable effect is simply that people are innocent wouldn't be prosecuted.
That prosecutors would be more careful about not prosecuting people who are, not convicting people who are innocent. What would be the undesirable effect? What's the flip side of that?
Not convicting people who should be convicted.
Nah. There's a much more interesting... What is required in order for you to get punished in this way? What two things have to happen in order for you to end up forfeiting your house to pay compensation to this guy?
You have to unjustly
and
convict somebody, and they have to discover
it. So what are the two margins on which behavior will be altered when you put in this rule?
The fervency in which you try and convict somebody, and then sort of the fervency in which you try and defend yourself.
In which you try not to let it be discovered that he's innocent. Right? So the flip side of it, the attractive side of that rule, is that it gives prosecutors an incentive not to push for conviction when they think it's quite likely the person is innocent. And the unattractive is that once it's happened, it gives them an incentive to make sure it's never discovered. All right? I gather from the stuff I've read on the DNA testing that there is already some incentive in that direction. At least in some jurisdictions, not all, it's hard to get permission to do the testing necessary to prove innocence. Well, that's understandable. People don't like it. People who made mistakes don't like it to be discovered. But you can see that it could be a whole lot harder up to the point of people deliberately finding excuses to destroy evidence if there were very serious penalties. So that's sort of one example of the economic approach of thinking not what is this law supposed to do, namely punish people who misuse their power, as it were, but how does this law make it in people's interest to behave? And those are two different questions, and the latter is probably more important if you want to decide whether you like a law or not. Let me give some other examples along similar lines. You all know probably more than I do about rules of discovery in civil litigation. Suppose we say we're going to alter the law to make it easier to do discovery, to expand the range of materials of the defendant corporation that the plaintiffs have access to. What are the consequences of doing that? What are the effects of making, of increasing, of suppose we decide, suppose it used to be the rule that the plaintiffs couldn't get at the email records of the defendant corporation, we now say they can. It used to be the rule that they couldn't get at the minutes of the board of directors meetings, so I suppose those are probably public, but now they can. In some way or another, we expand the ability to get such information. What are the consequences going to be? Yep. What's the very best way of hiding information? Never generate it. Let me take a very simple case. You're a car company. You, the top-level engineer, think it's possible, though not too likely, that there's a serious problem with the design of the car you're going to bring out. And the question is, should you get a team of your engineers to do some testing and look at this problem and see if it's a serious problem or not? And in a world where there's no discovery, say, you have a pretty strong incentive to do that. You don't want something to go wrong and you to get sued or to lose reputation or to, you know, have people not want to buy your cars. In a world with discovery, it may occur to you that if they investigate the problem and conclude that it's not serious enough to require an alteration of the design of the car, but that it is a potential problem, if they say, you know, yeah, sure, you know, one time in 10 million the brake's going to fail, but there's nothing much we can do about it without completely redesigning the car, that when that one time in 10 million happens and somebody is killed and you are sued, the fact that the records show that you knew about the problem is going to make it more likely you'll lose the case. So that would mean that one possible way of adapting to that world is not to set up that committee in the first place. Another way of doing it, I suspect, would be to have communications occur in less transparent forms, that you hint at things, you tell people things off campus, so to speak, that more generally, the more access other people have to the information you generate, the greater your incentive to avoid generating information they can have access to. Now, of course, there are other effects. It also may mean that guilty people get convicted more often because there's more evidence available to do it. So I'm not really arguing that this tells you you should or shouldn't do it. I'm only saying that you want to think in those terms of what incentives your legal rule gives people, rather than only asking what purpose are you trying to achieve with this legal rule. Let's take a different case. Think about the case where a homeowner shoots a burglar. And you could imagine rules which say that if he shoots the burglar, unless he has a good reason to do, he is civilly liable, which would, I think, be the case in some states. And, you know, if he's in fear, if he's legitimate fear of his life, he can almost certainly shoot the burglar. In Texas, I'm pretty sure, and I think some other states, if the only way of saving his life would be to flee his house, he's entitled to shoot the burglar instead. In other states, I think he is obliged to run if he can run. You can imagine a variety of rules along these lines. So suppose we make it easier for shot burglars to sue the people who shot them. What are the consequences? What's the obvious consequence? Presumably the one that's desired. What? That's probably not the desired one. That might indeed happen. That's a possible one possibility. But before you get to the more burglaries, maybe more burglaries because they're hoping to sue somebody, but that's not too likely. But what would be the first step that might then lead to more burglaries? People not being less willing to use deadly force against burglars, which might lead to more burglaries. The burglary becomes less dangerous. What's the other effect? What's the less obvious effect? Yeah?
I guess it's if the only witness to the situation is the burglar, you should shoot the killer.
Yes. True story. Many years ago, I lived in a house in Philadelphia, in a not terribly good neighborhood in Philadelphia, and I and my then wife were witnesses to a shooting. And the result of that was that we spent some time in court sitting around talking to police. I think my wife ended up testifying. I don't think I did. But I was, as a result, in sort of reasonably friendly conversation with police officers. And one of the police officers gave me some advice. And the advice he gave me was that if I should shoot a burglar, there were only two things I should make sure of. One of them was that he was dead. And the other was that his body was inside my house. All right? So he was, in fact, advising me to commit perjury, probably murder as well. And I was friendly advice, and he may well have been good advice. But I thought it nicely pointed up the sort of double-edged nature of this kind of a rule, that it gives you an incentive, just as in the case of convicting innocent people, it gives you an incentive not to do X, but also an incentive if you do X not to get caught. And the latter may be a perverse incentive, as I think it is in those cases. Let me take another case, and this is also a real and I think very fairly serious case. Are you familiar with what civil forfeiture is? Everybody? Nobody? No. Civil forfeiture is a legal rule under which property that has been used in certain illegal activities forfeits to the state. So that if you rent out your cabin cruiser in Florida to somebody and he uses it to smuggle marijuana into the U.S. and he gets caught, the cabin cruiser may forfeit. And two points that are worth noting about civil forfeiture: it does not require that the owner have done anything wrong. I don't have to know it's being used in that way. It doesn't even have to be shown that I could have known, because I'm not the defendant. The defendant is the cabin cruiser. All right. People make fun, people who look at old legal systems, at the Anglo-Saxon doctrine of the deodand, where a deodand is an object that is done but has committed a crime. But in fact, deodands are common in modern American law. There really is a case called something like the State of California versus 23 cans of film. I don't swear the number of cans of film. I don't swear the state, but it is cans of film. And in a civil forfeiture case, it is the property that the case is against. And the question is whether the property was used in an illegal activity, not whether its owner did anything wrong. And we have rather striking confirmation of this principle from the Supreme Court. because there was a case in which a man used his car to pick up a prostitute. And he was caught. This was illegal. The car forfeited. The car was half owned by his wife. The court held that his wife was not entitled to keep her half or to be reimbursed for her half, because there was no question whether the car had been used in an illegal activity, and the fact that she was in some sense the victim rather than the offender simply had nothing to do with legal status. Right? So that's the basic idea of civil forfeiture. What would you expect to be the desirable consequence of civil forfeiture, and what the perhaps undesirable consequence? We think about this as an incentive system. Why might you be in favor of it? Or letting other people do it. Giving the owners of cabin cruisers an incentive to be careful about who they rent their cabin cruisers to, basically. Right? Giving parents an incentive not to let their kids invite their friends over for a pot party. Because the house might forfeit, depending on the state and circumstances. What's the undesirable effect? The owner of the property isn't the only person whose incentives you might be worried about. Yeah? The undesirable effect is an incentive for the police to look for deep pockets, to look at property that could forfeit. Now, as I understand the case, and this is certainly not my specialty, I'm relying on somebody else's work, initially, in many states, the civil forfeiture statutes took account of this problem by providing the property did not go to the police department. That the property went to the education fund or to some part of the state government relatively distant from the officers who were doing the enforcing. At some point, federal law changed in a way that made it possible for federal law enforcement to adopt the seizure being made by state law enforcement and share the proceeds with the state law enforcement. So that this was, as I understand it, a way of evading the state rules on where the money went. According to Bruce Benson, a law professor in Florida, who's my source on this, the immediate consequence was a large shift of police resources into the war on drugs. Because the war on drugs involves large amounts of money lying around, which can be forfeited, and that became more profitable. And I was reminded of this a fair number of years ago. I got a phone call from somebody who said he wanted to know if I was willing to speak at a conference on money laundering in the Pacific Rim. And he identified himself, I should add, as a forensic accountant, which I thought was an interesting job description. And I said to him, well, you do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering. And he said, yes. And so I went. It was fun. The conference was mostly law enforcement people. And perhaps the most interesting thing was a series of talks about an extended law enforcement operation on money laundering, which, if I remember correctly, and this is a while back, so I may be wrong, netted something on the order of $100 million. So you can see that one of the things you want to worry about is that this gives people an incentive to decide what laws to enforce according to where there's property that you can forfeit rather than according to where there is damage being done. And there was, in fact, a case in California, I don't know how it finally came out, where you had some wealthy person who ended up being shot in his own house by police officers, where the police officers were not, I think, in fact, from his county. I think they were the next county over. And they claimed at least that they were searching for marijuana. They had some reason to think he was growing marijuana there. He came down the stairs and they thought he was armed or something and shot him. And one of the things that came out later was that they had been investigating the value of his real estate prior to the raid. So that would be, a case of the potential risks in this. And you'll find a good deal later in the book, I have a discussion of what I refer to as the inefficiency of efficient punishments, which is arguing that on the face of it, you'd like to have criminal punishments that look more like fines and less like jail sentences, because the nice thing about a fine is what the criminal loses, someone else gets. But you have to worry about that, because if you have something where somebody else gets something by convicting people, they have an incentive to convict people whether or not they're guilty. And so that's, as I say, we'll get to that maybe halfway through the course, but it's I think, a legitimate point that you want to worry about. So what all of this is suggesting is that economics provides a useful tool for predicting the consequences of laws. And I've been talking about particular laws, but you can also think about it of things such as common law rules. So that if you think about the rule of coming to the nuisance, which you're probably familiar with, that says that if I have a pig farm and you buy some real estate next to it planning a housing development and you there then sue me on the grounds that my pig farm is a nuisance that keeps your people from wanting to buy houses in your housing development, I have a defense on the grounds that pig farm was there first, you came to the nuisance. And you can use economics to argue why it might be desirable to have that rule, although it turns out that it's not as clear as it might first seem. And economics in general is a way of predicting the consequences of laws, which assumes the rationality of criminals, the rationality of victims, the rationality of tortfeasors, of tort victims. We want to think about how the knowledge that if you are injured, you can sue will affect your behavior. But it also assumes, or should assume, the rationality of cops, prosecutors, legislators, judges, and so forth. I say should because economic analysis of law as it's actually developed has focused a whole lot more on the enforcee side than the enforcer side. And most of it is really about the criminals, the tortfeasors, the victims, and not enough of it, I think, about the police, the prosecutors, and so forth. But in principle, that's all part of the same game, the same story, as it were. Let me take another example. All right, are you familiar with what the term the English rule refers to? This is the question of who pays for legal costs. That the American rule is that if I sue you, whether I win or lose, I pay my legal costs and you pay yours. And there are occasional exceptions. That's the normal rule. The English rule, loosely speaking, is the loser pays. So, loosely speaking, it is that if I sue you and win, you have to pay my legal costs. Now, I think it's not quite that simple. I think the judge has to decide what my legal costs should have been, as it were. But roughly speaking, it's what I said. And so the question is, what would be the effects of shifting from the American rule to the English rule? Think about this just sort of as a puzzle. Yeah? One argument is that if you think you're going to lose, you may have greater reasons not to sue. That's right. What other effect would you expect? Go.
Quicker settlements.
You might. Any other effects? Suppose you're deciding whether to invest some more money on trying to increase your chance of winning, whether to spend some more money on a better lawyer or on looking for more evidence or whatever. Under our rule, if you pay $1,000 in order to get a 1% chance increase in the chance of winning, what is the effect on your on you? You're out $1,000 and you've gained 1% of whatever the return from winning is. Suppose we're under the English rule, what happens? You're out $1,000 times the probability of losing, because if you win, he's going to pay it. And the value of winning is larger than before, because now the stakes are larger, because they include the litigation costs. So therefore, that 1% increase in chance of winning is worth more than before. So that's an argument which would suggest that the English rule would tend to increase. The opposite if you're settling earlier, but that's one that would suggest that it would have a tendency to increase litigation expenses because each person will correctly believe that there's a reasonable chance the other guy will pay for it. Now, again, that depends how it's applied, and it might be that the judge would say, sorry, you shouldn't have spent that $1,000, so we won't make him pay it. But if you take the sort of the English rule as it exists in theory as opposed to the tales of actual English law at the moment where it's just loser pays, then you're going to get that. On the subject of preventing frivolous lawsuits, by the way, one of the courses I teach every other year here is a seminar on legal systems very different from ours, which is quite a lot of fun. We start with modern gypsies. The gypsies in many different countries have been pretty good at staying below the radar of the official legal system in various ways and then enforcing their own rules on their own members. We go on from there to Imperial China, which is quite a fascinating legal system, lasted a couple of thousand years, roughly. And one of the ones we look at is ancient Athens. the Athens of Plato and Aristotle and all those nice people. And that turns out to be a lot of fun. And one of the things I thought was rather neat was their approach to the problem of frivolous litigation. Because in Athenian law, what we would think of as criminal cases are almost all privately prosecuted. That the basic rule is that any adult male Athenian citizen can prosecute a case. There are equivalent of civil cases where only the victim can prosecute, but what we would think of as a criminal case would be anyone. The usual punishment is a whopping large fine, and the successful prosecutor gets a cut of the fine, which is his incentive to prosecute. And that raises obvious problems along the lines we've thought of in the civil forfeiture context. However, the Athenians had very large juries, probably a couple of hundred people in a jury. And if the prosecutor fails to get, I think it was 30%, maybe 20%, 30%, something like that, of the jurors to vote for conviction, the prosecutor is fined. So that, again, gives you an incentive not to pursue frivolous suits or suits where there's a serious chance that almost nobody will be convinced. One of the other legal systems I look at is 18th century English criminal law, which is quite interesting, because on paper it's just like our system with the same distinction between civil and criminal law. There's just one small difference, and that is that there are no police and no public prosecutors. So it's a criminal law system that's privately prosecuted, but unlike the Athenian one, the successful prosecution doesn't get your prosecutor is not given anything. All right? And that then raises the question of why anybody bothered to prosecute, and it turns out that one reason to prosecute, I think, at least as I interpret it, was the hope of an out-of-court settlement, of getting paid off to stop prosecuting, which was illegal as it happens, but pretty clearly was happening. That seems to be what compounding a felony originally meant. And the other incentive was private deterrence. If you imagine that you're a cloth dyeing for a factory with lots of valuable cloth spread out where it's pretty easy to steal, you want the reputation that if people steal your cloth, they end up getting hanged. All right. Now you're an ordinary, well enough off to be a possible target of theft, but an ordinary English citizen, and you're not going to be the target of enough repeat crimes to build up a reputation. What they did was to create what they called associations for the prosecution of felons. And this is an organization of a bunch of the better-off citizens of a town, each of whom contributes a pound or two a year to a pooled fund which is available to be spent prosecuting a felony committed against any one of them. The names of the members of the association are published in the newspaper for the felons to read. So what that was deterrence converted into a private good. Private good because it was deterrence against committing crimes against those particular people. So that's, again, an interesting example where the economics, I think, makes sense out of what was happening in that particular system. All right, enough examples. Let me go on to talk about some other features of the general economic approach to understanding the law. And one of the central features is that it's ultimately forward-looking, not backward-looking. That the question is not really, given that these bad things have happened, how do we clean up? It is rather, how does the way in which we resolve this unfortunate situation affect the chance of it happening in the future? Let me give an example of that in daily life. I don't know if any of you are parents, but if you are parents, you very likely, and you have children who are, you know, above age two or so, or maybe three, you probably impose the rule, you made the mess, you clean it up. And at first glance, especially to a tired parent, that seems like a very stupid rule, because four-year-olds are really not very good at cleaning things up. So you end up spending 20 minutes of your time getting the kid to clean up a mess that you could have cleaned up in 3 minutes of your time. Why is it nonetheless a sensible rule? Yeah? That's right. It gives kids an incentive not to make messes. Let me take the same principle in a somewhat more adult context. Let us suppose that you have a roommate. Could be a wife, lover, ordinary roommate, whatever. But assume that you are about equally good cooks. And that you agree that a sensible deal is that one of you will cook dinner half the time and the other half of the time. And there are two ways you might organize the cooking and cleaning up. One of them is, I cook, you clean up tonight, you cook, I clean up tomorrow night. The other is, I cook, I clean up tonight, you cook, you clean up tomorrow night. And the question is, which one should you do? Can't be an issue of fairness. It's symmetrical either way. Same rule for both people. Yes?
I cook, you clean up.
Why do you want to do it that way?
So if I'm cooking and I'm cleaning up, I'm not going to cook an extravagant meal. Perhaps I'll just mix a hot pot and throw it out.
Do you in fact cook?
Oh, no.
Can I get an answer from somebody who cooks? I didn't make that condition initially, but there's a reason why knowledge of the technology, as it were, may be irrelevant. Somebody like to argue for the opposite of his conclusion. Yeah, I guess law students don't cook. My argument is for the other rule, and the reason is that the amount of mess made in cooking is not a random variable. It is a consequence of decisions by the cook. And you're taking a single decision of how simple a meal to make. And it's not even clear that in that case that, I mean, I could reverse it and say under your rule, I'll make too fancy a meal because I'll ignore all the extra work I'm making for you by these six pots I'm getting dirty. But the argument that I want to make is that when you're actually cooking for a given meal, there are lots of things determining how much of a mess you make. For example, while the water in the pot for the second part of the meal is coming to a boil, do I take the opportunity to wash out the frying pan? Do I make an effort to use the same pan for several purposes rather than a clean pan each time? How careful am I to make sure that I don't burn something onto the bottom of the pan, which is a real pain to clean off? So my argument would be that just as with a small child, the rule of you make the mess, you clean it up, gives people an incentive in deciding how to cook the meal to take account of the cost that they are imposing on somebody, themselves or someone else, via the way in which they do it. And that, in fact, is an example of a very general and very powerful principle that we'll be seeing again and again, which is that if you want people to take the right precautions, one way of doing so is to make sure they're the ones who bear the costs. So that if you say, it's not that you always want to take precautions. The optimal pattern of behavior will not make zero messes. All right? That would be being too careful. Just as, you know, one of the things that makes economics sound odd to non-economists is the fact that economists believe that there's an optimal number of traffic accidents. It isn't zero. Why isn't it zero? Because the cost of getting it to zero is abolishing the automobile. Automobiles are very useful things. So the optimal number would occur when every precaution which produced benefits larger than its cost was taken, and every precaution which produced costs larger than its benefits wasn't taken. Well, one way of getting people to act that way if people are rational is to make sure that I both bear the cost of the precaution and get the benefit of the precaution. And you can think of a lot of legal rules as an attempt to do that. And the very simplest and perhaps most important example would be the basic rule of tort law. What's the basic rule of tort law? What determines the damages in tort law? I've done you an injury. I am supposed to pay you enough money what? Two. What is fair? What is comp? To make... That's right. To make the victim whole. What does that mean? It means that if I took an action which imposed costs on you, the law will try to transfer those costs to me. Consequently, in deciding whether to take actions, I will take full account of the cost of them. A whole lot more complicated, as we'll be seeing later in the semester, but it's a good starting point. It's a way of if you think about the question of how can you design legal rules for efficient outcomes so that people will do things sort of that are worth doing and not doing things that are not worth doing, one starting point is, can we set things up so that the same person who makes the decision bears the cost and gets the benefits, of course. If you get the benefit and I bear the cost, we're going to have a problem as well because I won't do things that are worth doing. So in any case, I think in the book I run through a different example of the forward-looking attitude, which I'm also sort of fond of, and that's the nephew who goes mountain climbing with his rich uncle and takes the opportunity to push the uncle off the cliff. And by great ill fortune, there is a bird watcher on the next peak over who's got his telescopic lens pointed in just the wrong direction, and the result is the nephew finds himself in court. And after it's been demonstrated he indeed committed the murder, and it comes to the sentencing phase of the trial, the nephew's attorney says, look, Your Honor, my client has no more rich uncles. So you don't have to stop him from pushing rich uncles off the cliff. He has no more rich uncles. And if he did have another rich uncle, I can assure you he would not go mountain climbing with it, not after this. So there's really nothing useful achieved by punishing my client. So just, you know, now that you convicted him, send him home. What's wrong with that? From an economic standpoint, not from a justice standpoint. It's a point that judges have been aware of for a long time. Why do you? Yeah. That's right. The idea of punishing him is to make sure the next nephew doesn't push his rich uncle off a mountaintop or the equivalent. And the argument, therefore, that's what I'm calling it forward-looking, because it's not how do we deal with the killing that's already occurred, how do we make the way in which we deal that killing make it less likely that similar killings will occur in the future. That's right. And there's some famous, I think, 18th or 19th century quote from a judge which is making just this point, you know, we punish people not that, but in order that other people will not do it. But I think that's right. All right, so much on how economics can be used to understand the effect of laws. That's the first thing you can do. The first thing you can do is just apply economics to say, if you have this law, what will happen? And that's obviously a useful first step for almost anybody who's looking at the law. The second step is to predict or explain what the law is. So suppose you are a scholar and you say, well, the common law recognizes the principle of coming to the nuisance. The common law recognizes a